You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Joining us on the KTEP Book Club today is Dr. Tess Gerritsen. Dr. Gerritsen is a medical doctor. She's a physician, internationally best-selling author. She's gained nationwide acclaim for her first New York Times best-selling novel of suspense, Harvest. She also is the author of the bestsellers Rizzoli and Isles, Last to Die, The Silent Girl, Ice Cold, The Keepsake, The Bone Garden, The Mephisto Club, Vanish, Buddy Double, The Sinner, The Apprentice, The Surgeon, Life Support, Bloodstream, and one of my favorites, Gravity. And so we are very honored to have Tess Gerritsen with us today. Tess, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Oh, it'll be fun to talk with you today.
Now, first of all, as I mentioned before we started the interview, we like to get to know our authors a little better. And a lot of people don't pick up a book, read the story, and they'll go, wow, this is very interesting, not realizing what is behind that ink? What's behind those pages? What is behind that author who held that pen, pencil? As I mentioned, you are a physician. Tell us a little bit about your background and growing up. Did you grow up around a lot of books? Were you always interested in books, or had you always been interested in science?
I grew up reading a lot of mysteries. Nancy Drew was my favorite character when I was 7 years old, and I knew I wanted to be a storyteller when I was seven. But I had a Chinese-American dad who said, you'll never make a living as a writer. You better go into science. So I went to medical school. I became a doctor, which was really, really good background training for writing. And then finally went back to writing on maternity leave. So that I had a roundabout journey to becoming a novelist. And I think that that science background allows me not only to write about characters who have a medical background, but it also allows me, you know, I think the background to write about a variety of topics, everything from space biology to leopard behavior.
Now, your first novel, I want to say your first medical thriller, was Harvest, I believe, and it was released in hardcover in, 1996, and it made the New York Times bestselling list immediately, and you were followed by Life Support, Bloodstream, Gravity, which I told you I love, The Surgeon, The Apprentice, The Sinner, Body Double, Vanish, The Mephisto Club, Bone Garden, The Keepsake, Ice Cold, The Silent Girl, and The Last to Die. And we're talking today about Die Again, and we'll get to that in just a minute. But let's talk a little bit about when you did get your first published book. How was that?
You know, it was, you get a call. You get a phone call, and it's one of these, it's like the pinnacle of your dreams. Because as a struggling writer, you just never imagine that, you know, anything will ever happen with these stories. So it is. It's a wonderful first realization. Wow, I've done it. I've actually hooked an editor in and made them want to read the book and publish the book. But I think I've never really lost that excitement with every single story I tell. What's important is not the selling of the story. What's important is the writing of the story. Do these characters mean anything to you? Have I accomplished the goal as a storyteller that I set out, you know, to accomplish?
Let's talk a little bit about one of your other books, The Bone Garden. That's a very interesting book, and I don't want to give it away, but from what I remember, a young lady, divorced, buys a house, and she finds out, that when she's getting ready to garden and do everything else, she finds other stuff there.
Yeah, she finds human remains in her would-be garden. That story was one of the most interesting ones to research. It largely took place in 1830, and I wanted to look at the state of medicine early on in that century, because I had been reading about this thing called childbed fever. It's a really horrifying illness where women go into the hospital to have their children. They deliver safely. I mean, the birth is fine. But then within a couple of hours to maybe a couple of days later, they develop a fever, a shaking chills. Their whole body is overwhelmed by bacteria, and they die a truly horrible, painful death. And this was happening in huge numbers throughout hospitals in the United States and in Europe. And I thought what was horrifying about it was that the reason they were dying was because of their doctors. Doctors did not wear gloves. They did not wash their hands. They were infecting every woman in the maternity ward and killing thousands of women. So I wrote a story about the history of medicine. It happened to also be a murder mystery, but one of the major characters in that book was Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes, a real person who was the first American doctor to come up with why these women were dying. He was the first in the United States to tell his fellow doctors, we need to wash our hands. it's rather appalling to think about it now, that it was something so simple could have saved thousands of women, but it was not apparent at the time.
And it's interesting, as you mentioned that, because the same thing happened, I guess, with President Garfield. When he was shot, they claimed that it was doctors who killed him, because even though Dr. Joseph Lister had talked about germs, and some of these doctors back then thought, well, you know, how can you know more than me? I'm the medical person. And I guess it was kind of hard for them to come up with something like that. Something as simple as that.
That's absolutely true. I mean, doctors, you know, if you were, back in those days, you were better off not going to the hospital. You were better off staying home, having your baby in the fields. That would have been safer. And just as you didn't really want to go into the hospitals for anything, because what would they do? They would bleed you. That was the general cure for everything, is to take some blood out of you. So there was not a lot that doctors could do, but they could do a lot of harm.
Because of your medical background and you research and you write, a lot of people, when they read a book from you or from, say, Robin Cook or some of the other medical thrillers who are MDs, they realize that, hey, this person really knows what they're talking about. Not that the others don't, but you've been there. You've done that. And so when you write, you write about something that you really know about.
Well, I try to. When I write about medicine, I feel pretty comfortable writing about that. But I'm always going further afield because I like to indulge my curiosity. So I have written about the space program. I have written about Egyptology. This time I've written about Africa. And I want to know more. I want to learn stuff. And when I encounter something in my research that freaks me out or that makes me go, oh, my God, this is really fascinating, that's goes into the book, because I think my readers are probably as curious as I am. I think that's the kind of person who reads mysteries. They are intellectually curious people.
And sometimes you put it out in your novels and your books, and it makes us think, wow, this could really happen. And all of your novels point that way. And one of the ones that I remember reading also is Bloodstream. And when you read that, you're going, oh my gosh, you know, that could really be happening somewhere.
Well, yeah, the microbial world is pretty scary. I think we've discovered so much about human disease having to do with microbes that we weren't aware of. For instance, as you know, stomach ulcers. For many years when I was practicing medicine, this is way back in the ancient years, when you would have ulcers, peptic ulcers, they would give you antacids, and eventually, if nothing worked, they would cut out part of your stomach. They'd go to surgery. And now we know that in large part, these peptic ulcers are caused by a bacterium called Helicobacter pylori. And now we treat it with antibiotics. What a terrible thing we did to cut out the stomachs of so many people when all they really needed was a course of antibiotics. So as time goes by, we are discovering more and more about the interaction between the microbial world and our health. So what happened in Bloodstream was essentially about parasites.
We are speaking with award-winning author and Dr. Tess Gerritsen. She is the author of the recent novel, Die Again. It's a Rosalian Isles book. And this is a perfect time to get into, because you mentioned you like to explore different areas, different types of genres. And with Rosalian Isles, you did that and you've created some great characters. Tell us about when you first wrote the first Rosalian Isles book. Did you anticipate that perhaps this would carry on?
No, it was the first book was The Surgeon, and it was a serial killer book having to do with medicine and the symbolic power of blood. You know, blood is really, I think, fascinating to all of us because it's sort of an alarming color, and it's also a sign of danger. So I wrote this book called The Surgeon, and Jane Rosoli was introduced as a minor character. She walked onto the page, and she was immediately annoying to everybody, including me. I didn't like her, and I think many of my readers didn't like her early on in that story. But to me, it didn't matter because I was going to kill her. Jane Rosoli was supposed to die in that first book. But over the course of a couple of months, spending time with her, developing her, I realized I understood this woman. I began to identify with her because she is an outsider. She is the only woman in the homicide unit. She's a tomboy. She's having trouble being accepted. And when it came time to kill her, I couldn't do it. So Jane Rosoli survives, and I wanted to know more about her, and I wrote the second book, which was The Apprentice, introduced a minor character named Dr. Maura Isles, and wanted to know more about her by the end of that story. So that's how I ended up with this series. These two women, the stars of a series, were never intended to be continuing characters, and yet they are now because they took over and became major characters.
As far as developing characters like this, and then when a network comes up to you like TNT and they want to develop a television show, how do you feel about that as an author, and how much control do you have as far as this is the way I want them to be portrayed, etc.?
Well, I have no control over it. I sold them the rights to the characters. But I don't feel there's a downside to it. I feel incredibly lucky and thrilled that they would take these two women and turn them into characters on a continuing series. I got the call from a producer. I remember he said, "I've been reading your books. I love your girls, and I think they belong on TV." And I was amazed when it all came together when TNT picked it up, and they hired these lovely actors to play the roles. And now it's going into it'll be going into its sixth season next year and into syndication as well. So I don't have anything to do with the show. They write their parallel stories, and it's a little bit odd because now Jane and Maura have gone from average-looking women to glamorous women on television. There are like parallel universes. I write my books and they do the stories on television.
We are speaking with Dr. Tess Gerritsen. She is award-winning author, New York Times bestselling author, and her recent book is Rizzoli and Isles, Die Again. Tell us a little bit about this book, because as you mentioned, you like to explore different areas, and this one takes us out into the bush, out into Africa.
Yeah, it was inspired by an experience I had while I was on safari a couple of years ago. We had a beautiful day driving through the bush, stopped for cocktails at sunset, and as we were standing around with our gin and tonic, a leopard walked out of the bush and came toward us. Our guide just told everybody to freeze, and he moved in between us and the leopard, stared the cat down, and the cat decided not to attack and went back into the bush. It was a really frightening moment, but it made me super aware of how important it is to trust your guide. Then the thriller writer takes over, and I'm thinking, what if our guide is not who he said he was? We're in the middle of a dangerous place. You have to trust somebody, but what if you put your trust in the hands of the wrong man? And that inspired the story of Die Again, which is about a group of tourists who fly in from around the world, go into the bush on the safari of a lifetime, and vanish from sight, are never seen again.
Now, what about, as you're talking about back in the United States, and then they're exploring some homicides, and you have Dr. Crow, you have Rizzoli, you have Isles, and there seems to be a little bit of interaction there as far as professionalism goes, because Dr. Crow, I believe he's the one, Detective Crow, who is very savvy, egotistical, puts on the best suit. And you can picture that already before even, when you're reading that. And so it's one of these things I'm picturing, like, I guess the doctors who were serving, taking care of President Garfield. Everybody wants to be better than the other one, and nobody wants to outdo the other.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a certain amount of arrogance that goes along with just about every profession. There are arrogant detectives and there are arrogant doctors. And Jane has had to deal with Detective Crow from the very first book, so they have a history going back of not liking each other. And the real drive or the real engine of any fiction is conflict. So this conflict between Jane and Detective Crow is always going to be there. There is also some conflict between Jane and Maura. They may like each other, they may respect each other, but they are not the same person, and they will disagree. And in this case, they disagree about the meaning of the wounds, the larger picture of these murders, whether they are connected with something else. And it's Maura who actually realizes that these murders that are happening in Boston, which appear to be done by a large cat, are probably connected to something that happened in Africa.
And as you mentioned, wounds, you make your characters very real. And people realize that, doctors are people. They have feelings like the rest of us. And when you're talking about wounds that they're looking at, you're talking about it from a medical examiner, from a police point of view. But these ladies also talk about their wounds and their personal wounds emotionally because of Daniel, because of Gabriel, because of Dad, etc.
Yeah, well, they're like, to me, they're real people, and real people just don't have a job. They have lives as well. Because these women have been going through so many books, I've been able to spend a lot of time with them. I know what's going on in their lives, and they're complicated. Maura has not been lucky in love. She has been divorced once. She's had some lovers who have not really been good choices. She's an intelligent woman who makes unintelligent choices when it comes to romance. And I know women like that. So she's dealing with loneliness and, some depression on her part. She's also dealing with a crisis personally with her mother. Her mother is in prison for murdering a number of people, and her mother is now calling out for Maura's help. What should she do? Should she reconnect with this really, truly evil person who she has a little bit of fear of, or should she stay away? And, of course, Jane has an issue with her parents, that her mom was abandoned by Dad, who ran off with another woman, and now Dad wants to come home. What should Jane's mom do? So these are some real-life stories that are going on in the backgrounds of their lives while they're trying to solve this case.
We're visiting with Dr. Tess Gerritsen. Dr. Gerritsen is the award-winning New York Times bestselling author of various medical thrillers and thrillers, the most recent, Rizzoli and Isles, Die Again. And I guess recently with the release of the movie Gravity, a lot of people thought, including myself, that this was based on your book. And I know that on your blog and on other places you explain what you're talking about and what people think. And personally, I'm not sure if it was related or not, but your book wins hands down, regardless of whether it's related or not. So I'm not sure if you wanted to say anything about this.
Well, yeah, the basic information is on my website, but I can talk about it because the lawsuit has been filed. You know, when I sold the movie rights back in 1999 to a division of Warner Brothers, I wrote additional scenes for the script for the production company that included scenes of satellite debris destroying the International Space Station, and my lone female surviving astronaut left adrift in her spacesuit. That movie never got made, and then the film Gravity was made. It came out last year. Actually 2 years ago now, and it was written and directed by Alfonso Cuarón. And the parallels were disturbing, right down to the title and the fact she's a female astronaut who's a medical doctor. But I had no proof, so I wasn't going to do anything about it. And I just kept saying it may be a coincidence, and I was told from the film company that there was no connection until February of last year when I was informed that was not true, that, in fact, the director that was attached to direct my film in the year 1999 was Alfonso Cuarón. So that's when my literary agent said it's time to call a lawyer, and we filed a lawsuit. And so it's in the process. We're waiting for the court to rule on a motion to dismiss by Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers made the film Gravity, and they also own the rights to my book, so it would be a breach of contract.
We are visiting with Dr. Tess Gerritsen. Dr. Gerritsen is an award-winning author. Her latest novel is The Rizzoli and Isles, Die Again. And you've written a variety of books, a number of books, Dr. Gerritsen. And I was wondering, as far as the cover goes, because you have very interesting covers, and depending on, I guess, which edition you buy, the cover is different. Tell us about the covers of your books.
I have to give all credit to my publisher because I don't make any decisions on that. What they will do is I have a contractual right to say no to a cover. What they usually give me, what they think is a good design, and I'll say yes or no. And I have had some amazingly beautiful covers, but they change. I mean, from hardcover to paperback, the cover will change. It also happens internationally. The English publishers, for instance, will not like the American cover, and they'll do their own. So you see a whole variety of interpretations of what the illustrations would look like of the story, and I get the pleasure of seeing it come in from around the world.
And because, as you mentioned, if people go to your homepage, they have there where you can see the United States cover and the UK cover, and they're all very different. Same book. If you're a fan, you want to collect both of them because it's a different cover. Now let's talk about audiobooks, because a lot of people are saying this is great. In fact, Lee Child told us about the fact that he associates it with the old storytelling, the radio dramas, and the fact that if you have a good narrator, a good reader, and sometimes even a good dramatization, that will add a lot to the audiobook.
Yeah, you know, the audiobooks, they have their own producer. They choose their own actors. I would only caution people who buy these books to try and get the unabridged audiobooks because the abridgments often leave out, you know, up to two-thirds of the story. And you're missing out on a lot of detail there.
We're visiting with Dr. Tess Gerritsen. Dr. Gerritsen is the award-winning novelist, and a recent book is Die Again, Rizzoli and Isles. Tess Gerritsen has written additional books as well, and Gravity is a very interesting book. I mentioned it's one of my favorites, and when you read it, you can even find some connections to the El Paso area because of White Sands Missile Range and the space shuttle and all that stuff. So I thought that was a great book. I've read it several times, listened to it several times, and given away many copies. But let's talk about, because you had to change careers. You said you were on maternity leave after being a medical doctor, and then you became a writer. Has that been difficult? Was that difficult? And also, what about your children? Did they go out in the same genre as you did, as far as writing? Or
it was not difficult to leave medicine because I always wanted to be a writer since I was a kid. I went into medicine because my father told me I could never make a living as a writer as a kid. So it was a simple transition for me. My children, my two sons, find my writing too disturbing, and they don't read my books. I know my son's roommate in college read one of my books and said to my son, "Dude, your mom is sick." So our dinner conversations at home were probably very disturbing to them as well, because we wrote that my husband's a doctor as well. And finally, sometimes my sons would clap their hands over the ears and say, "Please, no more."
So they wouldn't ask you to tell them bedtime stories.
We told them much more pleasant bedtime stories, and my sons do not have a big appetite for gore.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Dr. Gerritsen, for being with us. Our guest has been Dr. Tess Gerritsen. She is the award-winning New York Times bestselling author of various books. The most recent is Die Again from the Rizzoli and Isles collection. And you have a Facebook page and you have a homepage, author page as well, right, Tess?
Right. Tess Gerritsen. .com is my homepage, and it's GERRITSEN.
And as far as your books, they're available as audio, ebooks, and paperback?
Right. Yeah, all media forms, and you can buy them anywhere.
Do people need to read the other Rizzoli and Isles in order to be into this book?
Die Again is one of those books where you can pick it up and you don't need to read the previous ones. It is really a good way to come into the series. And if you like it, then you can go back and find out where Jane and Maura come from.
All right. Well, Dr. Gerritsen, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you.
We've been visiting with Dr. Tess Gerritsen. Tess Gerritsen is the New York Times bestselling author of various books, the most recent, Die Again, a part of the Rizzoli and Isles collection.
Okay. Go, boys. Go.
A classic musical in depth. I'm Bill Newcott, and from AARP Studios, this is Movies for Grown-Ups.
It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot.
Ann Miller wows them with her steamy number, It's Too Darn Hot, from the 1953 MGM musical Kiss Me, Kate. Filmed in 3D, the film was made at the height of Hollywood's first 3D revolution. As that 3D fad faded, the original 3D version of Kiss Me, Kate was nearly forgotten, and for 60 years, only a flat-screen version was available. Now Warner Brothers Home Entertainment has released the original Kiss Me, Kate in all its 3D glory on Blu-ray disc. With songs by Cole Porter, it's the story of two actors who went through a bitter divorce, but who are now reunited in a new musical version of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. MGM stalwarts Howard Keel and Catherine Grayson play the unhappy pair, who momentarily forget themselves during an impromptu backstage rehearsal of Porter's famous waltzing love song.
Wunderbar, wunderbar. Star above.
What a bright, shining star.
Like our love, it's wonderful.
For decades, viewers may have wondered why director George Sidney had Keel sweep Grayson into his arms during that song and carry her through a bunch of doorways. Well, the restored 3D version explains that. It looks really cool in 3D.
Any Tom, Dick, or Harry. Any Tom, Harry, or Dick.
It's easy to see why 3D petered out in the 1950s. It was always demanding you pay as much attention to it as you did to the actors. Like 3D, movie musicals were already on the decline by 1953, but Kiss Me, Kate's songs are as bright as ever, and the cast has that special brand of energy that seemed unique to MGM. Kiss Me, Kate, the original 3D version, is now available on Blu-ray disc. I'm Bill Newcott.
This is Primetime Postscript. I'm Mike Cuthbert. For centuries, the bandura has served as a cultural touchstone for the Ukrainian community. This instrument helped singers tell truths to royalty, entertain the public, and keep the Ukrainian diaspora in touch with their heritage. Yet the bandura has shaped one man's life in particular. Willis Arnold reports.
Julian Katasti sits in his kitchen in Manhattan's East Village. A thin layer of dust covers the countertop. Gray hair falls past his shoulders and his beard is white. Katasti's bandura, an instrument that hails from the Ukraine, rests against his leg.
It's a song about truth and about falsehood. And it's 300 years old, 400 years old, but only as old as the headlines in this morning's papers.
The bandura looks oddly like a cross between a harp, tall and flat with a bulbous curve, and a guitar with a long neck. This musical tradition is inherited from wandering musicians who traveled 15th century Eastern Europe, singing moral narratives for kings and queens.
They became the carriers of an oral history and a poetic tradition, and as such are tremendously important in Ukrainian culture.
Katasti's father, a Ukrainian immigrant, taught him to play as a kid. Petro Katasti was exiled by the Stalinist regime in the 1940s, in part because of his connection to musical and cultural traditions. The Katasti clan and their ensemble settled in Detroit, Michigan, where Petro Katasti and an uncle got jobs at car manufacturing plants.
My great uncle wrote some of his compositions while locked up in the bathroom stall at the Dodge plant.
The jobs were a necessity, a way to pay bills while they continued to follow their musical passion.
They figured that they could come and people could work, and then if there was a concert tour coming up, they could all quit and go on tour and then get jobs again when they got back.
Julian Katasti learned to play in a church basement on Detroit's Michigan Avenue. Practice consisted of his father and a couple other youths playing beneath flickering fluorescent lights.
It certainly helped hold the community together in a cultural way. When I started playing in the 60s and 70s, there were youth bandura ensembles like that in almost every city.
Katasti traveled the U.S. with one ensemble, visiting Ukrainian communities from coast to coast. The bandurists were a signpost of their shared heritage and the old country they'd fled.
The audiences I started playing for were tremendously forgiving, I have to say, because, you know, they were primarily excited about the fact that a kid born in America was, you know, playing this instrument at all, let alone passably well.
Katasti stayed true to the music of his father and his heritage, but he embraces what he's learned from his life in the U.S., too. In the 1970s, he developed a fascination with experimental music. He sees a connection between the ancient bardic music and experimental composers.
I define my identity in this, you know, melting pot world and not melt.
It's an identity he'd like to share.
To play the concert knowing that you've been able to bring beauty into the lives of all these people that they didn't know existed. That's just a thrill every single time.
This spring, Katasti will release a record of original bandura music. Until then, he'll be practicing in his kitchen and performing around the world. From New York, I'm Willis Arnold.
This has been Primetime Postscript, made possible by AARP and today, Willis Arnold. To hear more stories and postscripts, please visit aarp.org/radio.
Special thanks to the AARP in Washington, D.C. for use of Movies for Grownups and also for the Primetime Postscript. Editing for the show and producing for the show for today came from Belinda Fernandez, our KTEP production assistant for Perspectives.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.